It's The World in Words. I'm Patrick Cox.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
What is going on? We have the story today of an Iraqi writer caught up in the on-again, off-again ban.
We have no choice.
Nina Polzuki's here. Nina.
Hey.
Have you been to any of those seven countries? You know, the ones that make up Trump's travel ban?
Nope. I have never been to Iraq, Iran, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, Libya, or Syria. They're all completely unknown to me.
Me too. It's like so many people, like you and me, we just don't know about those places. But on the other hand, people from those places, they seem to know quite a bit about America.
Or perhaps they thought they knew a little bit about America. It seems like nowadays people are rethinking what they thought about America.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as soon as the travel ban was announced, I tried to get in touch with a bunch of people from those places. And not just people who couldn't get into the U.S., but also people who were already here and they didn't want to leave because they didn't know if they'd be allowed to come back in again. So I ended up going to New York to visit one of these people. She's an Iraqi woman. She's bilingual, almost from birth, Arabic and English.
My name is Anoud. It's a pen name.
A pen name, Anoud, like A-N-O-U-D?
Yeah, that's right. It means stubborn, but in a sort of positive way in Arabic.
Great.
And people think Bedouin when they hear it.
I arrived end of December. I think about the last week of Obama's presidency, yeah.
Wait, she just came to the U.S. in December? Like a mere month before the travel ban.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the very first time she'd been to the U.S. She'd
wow.
never been here before.
Wow.
So she entered the country on a fiancé visa. She was engaged to be married to an American. She is now married. And then almost immediately, Donald Trump becomes president.
Jeez.
So within a few weeks, there is an edict from Washington mm-hmm. banning people from your country from coming here.
Yes. I mean, it feels very strange.
I should say that when I talked to Anoud, it was before the court in Washington State lifted the travel ban.
So have you spoken to her since? How is she feeling? Is she feeling any different?
Yeah, we've spoken on the phone since the court ruling, and she doesn't really feel that much different. She does say that maybe somebody in her own family could now come and visit her. Her sister has got a tourist visa for the U.S., is all ready to go. But in terms of Anoud getting on a plane, leaving the U.S., there's no way she's going to do that. She doesn't even want to take a domestic flight. Not while Trump is president.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, so the ban, now that it's been put on hold, not just by the court in Washington, but also by the Ninth Circuit Appeals Panel, maybe that's not coming back. But the White House has said they're going to appeal it, and they've also made it very clear that they could issue another ban at any time. So it's no wonder that Anoud is wary of going anywhere near a plane.
Even when and if I get my green card, I am a little cautious not to travel. My brother's wedding is coming up soon. I don't think I'll be able to go. So it's definitely put everything on halt right now. Yeah.
If that sounds stressful, well, Anoud is used to it. She grew up in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, where one ill-chosen word, one phrase that could be taken the wrong way could cost you dearly. Anoud was born in the city of Mosul. Yes, that city that's made all the headlines recently for being the largest ISIS stronghold in Iraq that the Iraqi army is in the process of retaking right now. When she was a toddler, the family moved from Iraq to the UK. Her father was studying there. They spent several years in the UK and after that in Ireland. Anoud attended local schools. Her English became better than her Arabic. And then, when she was 8, the family went back from Ireland to Iraq, to Baghdad.
And I remember when we went back to Iraq, I kept telling my mom, I refused to speak in Arabic. I kept saying, take me back home, I'm Irish. And my mom would say, shut up, you're not Irish, you're an Iraqi, get over yourself. As a child, I was the storyteller. I made stories up, but I started writing first in Arabic. So when I moved to Baghdad, my first year at school, there was a teacher. Her name was Miss Inam. And she saw me scribbling in a book once, in a textbook. She said, what are you writing? And I was writing a story. I had that thing. Because I lived in my own bubble and I didn't have too many friends. And she gave me this notebook as a gift. I remember it. It was this recycled Iraqi paper where it's coarse and it has you'll find bits of newspaper in it. And if you try to use the eraser, the paper starts to crumble. It's like cheap, you know, recycled paper from Iraq and the economic sanctions almost. Anyway, she gave me this notebook. She said, write and show me what you write. So I started writing my first short stories when I was, I guess, 10. And I started showing them to her. And then it was like this bug and I caught fire.
Okay, so Anoud was writing these stories and writing them in Arabic too, which wasn't always easy for her, having spent so long away. Also, she found out she had to be careful what she wrote in Saddam Hussein's Iraq.
There was a lot of fear of, you know, people were being detained for no reason. No one should speak out against the government. People were terrified. And so every time I tried to speak my mind, and I was a very opinionated child. I mean, my father says at the age of 9, I think, I wrote a letter and I said, Father, post this to Saddam. And I was telling him how to run his country. That's the kind of child I was. And so whenever I spoke about politics or asked questions, my father would always say, stop talking, you're going to get us all executed. That was his favorite phrase. Stop talking, you're going to get us all executed. And so I would write these political stories. And then I would be so afraid that I would end up burning them. And so I would write these stories, I would create these worlds, and I would burn them. And I would feel very guilty because I lived with these characters and I felt I was, in a way, almost murdering them. So when I was about 14 years old, I met a friend. She still lives in Baghdad, but she's a very close friend of mine. My friend was very outgoing and a bit of a rebel. And so we started to walk around Baghdad, take buses to the far edges of town. I discovered the book bazaar. I started to love the city in a way that an outsider would.
This was in the early 1990s. Iraq had hit hard times after losing the first Gulf War.
Even with the economic sanctions and everything else, I mean, there were times when we would wait in line for 4 or 5 hours to fuel our car or get bread. And it was difficult. But I didn't mind it. I still felt the city had a lot of potential. It was isolated from the rest of the world. Our museums were empty. There's something about going into an art center. At the time, it was Saddam Art Center. It's sad, but it's also kind of romantic because, you know, you walk around, you take your time, you're the only one there, you meet a curator, and they're bored and they just want to talk to someone. And then you have this amazing tour, and then they take you to the cellar and show you more artwork, and it's so exclusive. And it's my city. It's where I feel most grounded.
That museum, by the way, the Saddam Art Center, it was looted and burned to the ground a few years later, after the U.S. returned in 2003, occupied Baghdad, and allowed Iraqis to run riot in their city and destroy some of it. Anoud wrote about all of these things and more. At college, she showed her work to a professor who she trusted.
He called me in and he said, you know, this is great, I think you should try publishing, but why the hell are you writing in Arabic? And I said, what do you mean? He said, because I was writing about Iraq, economic sanctions, life in Iraq. It was a very local narrative. And he said, write in English, talk to them. And he waves his arm. He says, talk to them, talk to them. Why are you preaching to your own choir? And I thought, okay, actually, I haven't written a story in Arabic since my senior year in college. neither Arabic nor English are solely my comfort zone. I am more comfortable reading in Arabic. I miss reading books in Arabic. But I feel now that I am better at expressing myself in English. And sometimes I get annoyed with Arabic because I feel that it can get a little redundant. It's not just the language, it's the way of thinking. When I speak in Arabic, I notice that I end up, you know, repeating myself. Like, it's so lovely to see you. Oh, I'm so glad to see you. It's really nice to see you. I haven't seen you in ages. You just change. Whereas, you know, when you are thinking in English, you become a little more to the point. I even sometimes, if I dream and I remember my dream, honestly, sometimes I dream in English and sometimes I dream in Arabic. It's down to that level. I think in both cultures.
Do you have the same dream in each language?
No, I don't. It's just, and I rarely dream now, but when I do have some weird dream and I wake up and I remember it, there are times when the language I am using or is being used in the dream is English, and there are times it's Arabic. And even when I am thinking to myself, I catch myself sometimes thinking in English, sometimes thinking in Arabic. If I'm angry, it's most likely to be Arabic, because there's something about cursing in Arabic that just like, you know, it kind of hits a core.
They nail it, huh?
It nails it, absolutely. Yeah, Arabic will, it will give you that release.
So Patrick, what happens to the anger that she's talking about here that's so fun to express in Arabic? How does that anger translate into English?
Well, I think it's still there. It just isn't expressed in those kind of fantastic Arabic curse words. You can still feel it, though, along with a ton of really dark satirical humor. Let me give you a flavor of it.
Okay.
This is from Anood's latest published story. It's called Karamana, and it imagines an Iraq in the future, nearly 100 years from now.
Ah, science fiction.
Here's the opening. The day Karamana was to be wed to Mullah Hashish, she stabbed him in the right eye and ran to the American annex of Sulaymaniyah. The local media of the Islamic Empire of Wadi Hashish had not yet caught up on the matter. While the rest of the world was using holographics, because maintaining fiber optic cables across water war zones had proved impossible, Wadi Hashish considered anything but paper newspapers printed out on metal presses to be Western blasphemy. Plus, the people of Wadi Hashish were never in a hurry. By the time Karamana had snuck out of the last Wadi Hashish checkpoint, Akbar al-Imara, News of the Empire, had just ran this on their front page. Oh, what a joyous day of jubilation! Allahu Akbar! The Islamic State of Wadi Hashish today wears its festive green and black ribbons on every street lamp. Civil servants have been ordered by the great, the brave lion, the sword of Allah, Amir Mullah Hashish, may Allah reward him in abundance, to cook giant pots of lamb stew at every intersection to feed the poor as a gesture of his generosity on the day he is to wed the most beautiful woman in the empire. Hold on, just turn the page here. According to our sisters, as the virtual Amir, may Allah reward him in abundance, has never laid eyes on a woman before. Comma. Are you noticing, Nina, how long this particular sentence is? I think it's in the style of an Arabic language newspaper. Oh. Picking up from that comma, no other than our blue-eyed sister, Karamana. The grand wedding reception for men will be held in the courtyard outside Wadi Hashish municipality tomorrow at sunset. Attendance is mandatory.
Well, first, is it wrong that I like really also feel nostalgia for the days of newspaper when the news could be wrong or move on, but we all just sort of stay with it for a moment and everything doesn't sort of slip forward? Is that a terrible reaction to this dystopic reflection of Iraq?
Maybe it's not quite the intended one.
How much of this like dystopia is a reflection of Iraq today?
Well, I guess quite a lot. And this is what Anood told me about that.
when you read the story, you know geographically where this is. You know that this is Mosul and where ISIS are. And Kahramana is the only one who has blue eyes, and so she stands out. She's very exotic, and she's to be wed to the leader of this Islamic empire. I won't kill the story for people who want to read it, but she ends up running away to an American dominant part of Iraq. Over the years, I've worked in refugee camps. I've built up a lot of resentment to what I see, but I've also developed a sense of humor. When you've lived through three wars and you've seen it hit the fan so many times, you have to sit back and just make fun of it. And so in Kahramana, I was making fun of the humanitarian world, the people who are supposed to take care of refugees, making fun of immigration processes, but also making fun of refugees as well, because, and I get this a lot as an Iraqi, very often I find a person who's European or American who just wants to pet me on the head like a puppy and go like, oh my God, you're Iraqi. Oh, how cute, how nice. We're so sorry. Get over yourselves. I'm just, you know, it feels very strange. So I wanted to make fun of everyone and everything.
And back to the anger that underscores all of this. Anu told me that she wrote this story after she was pulled out of the line at Heathrow Airport trying to board a plane. And then she was given the third degree, which is something that, you know, happens a lot to her, but it doesn't really make it any easier. And I suppose you could say the good thing is that she managed to channel her anger into this hilarious send-up of Iraq and ISIS and America.
Yeah, it's interesting that she doesn't shy away from making fun of ISIS.
Yeah, far from it. In fact, before she came to the U.S., she was in London doing research for news organizations on ISIS. So she was reading every day. She was reading and analyzing blog posts and tweets and all kinds of communications from ISIS sites. So she got to know their MO pretty well.
I'm obsessed with ISIS and with Al-Qaeda, and I'm very curious to see how they think and how they mobilize and how they recruit and why people want to join them. And also my family has personally been attacked by radical Islamic groups, so it's very, you know, close, up close and personal to me. And when you understand Arabic and you understand how ISIS think, and then you listen to the Trump administration and the people who support Trump, and I'm not saying everyone who supports Trump is bad, but some of them are specifically picking on the rhetoric that says ban Muslims, ban immigrants, all Arabs are crazy, all Muslims need to be kicked out of the United States. It is the exact same way of thinking of someone who supports ISIS, says all Americans are bad, every Westerner is bad, you can't speak English, you can't be a Westerner, or you're an infidel. And that applies to an American or to someone like me who, you know, a woman who doesn't wear a headscarf, speaks more English than Arabic. I'm sort of in that lot as well. I wish more people could see both sides of the story. It is amazing how identical they are. And it's no secret that ISIS are actually using segments of some things Trump said even a year back. And they're using that in their propaganda videos to justify and to mobilize and to recruit. So hatred breeds hatred.
Yeah, that's a really depressing thought. I mean, really depressing and illuminating thought. It's like also what we've seen in so many news articles or news headlines that people are afraid that, you know, what we're doing is just fanning the flames more and more. She mentioned speaking English versus speaking Arabic, and they're like, right. She's choosing sides almost. Does she see it that way? It's like she's choosing sides? I mean, she's bilingual. She loves Arabic. She wrote her stories in it, but now she's speaking English. She's living in America. That English is primarily going to be her first language. Does she feel like she's choosing sides?
I think that she doesn't feel she's choosing sides politically, but she has chosen English as the language that she wants to write in. So she's kind of sad about the fact that she's leaving Arabic behind. I mean, she spoke with some regret about not reading in Arabic enough and not even writing in Arabic enough because her Arabic is, you know, she's a native speaker. But her association with Arabic is just too bound up in feeling something rather than figuring it out?
Arabic has a lot of adjectives, and it can be, you know, it's a good way to express emotions and opinions. And when I think in English, I'm not expressing emotions and opinions. I'm describing shapes, colors, sounds, smells, things I see. I try not to describe. I'm very careful at not telling people something is ugly or beautiful. And I feel that I'm more at ease when I write in English. And maybe because I've been writing in English since I was in college, that when I try to write in Arabic, the adjectives automatically creep in.
Okay, so Patrick, where can I read the full story? Where can I read Anud?
The story Karamana is in this fantastic collection of stories by a bunch of different Iraqi writers. It's called Iraq Plus 100. And all of the stories in this collection, they imagine Iraq in the year 2103. So it's 100 years after the U.S. invasion of 2003. Hmm. And I'll post the link at PRI.org/language. And you know, Nina, even though it's been just a few weeks that Anud has been living in the United States, she's adjusting super quickly. She's got to know people in the neighborhood, the people in the bodegas, the cafes. Right. And, you know, she's obsessing about a new Twitter feed, not ISIS this time, but guess who? Donald Trump.
Of course.
Maybe some fiction will come out of that.
America in the year 2103. We had production help this week from Robin Moore and Catherine Whalen. Thanks so much.
Also, a big thank you to Christopher Merrill. The World in Words is a production of PRI's The World. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.